All crews, he called. He gave the coordinates, and each of the squadron leaders confirmed, all the way down the line of tanks, supply vehicles, fuel carriers and ammo trucks. The ground began to tremble as the entire brigade swung round and turned off the highway into the trackless wastes of Cadia Prime. They headed northeast, bounding over the ploughed-up tracks of what could only be Leviathans and the distinctive mark of Warlord Titan footprints. It was exhilarating to be moving again, with the wind in their faces. They passed burned-out tanks, the crater in which a warlord had exploded, the scattered shapes of dead men lying where they had fallen, in heaps at times, five or six deep. The bodies had been dead for months. As the tanks rolled over them, they bobbed and bounced on the corrugated surface. The stench of old, burned human flesh was horrible. Only the cold kept the flies down. Who knew whether they were heretics or loyalists? The tanks ran straight over them, barely pausing. War had come to Cadia in all its scale and horror. Lards had seen it as bad as this before, but not many times. As the land levelled out, Hesk changed up gears and pressed his foot on the accelerator. Lars felt the engine begin to hum as they changed out of third gear for the first time in 3 days. Despite the stink, it was good to feel the wind through the windows. Good to be moving at speed once more. Good to be delivering the counterblow at last. When they reached point 67, Lars Henny brought his column to a halt. "This is it," he said. Hesk opened his hatch and looked out.
"So what do we do now?"
Lars checked his chronometer.
"We wait," he said.
Hesk sniffed. All of Cadia looked pretty much the same these days, a burned, barren wasteland. All that differed was the wrecks, which showed where battles had been fought.
"How long?"
2 hours.
"And then?"
"We attack." Hesk nodded. There was a long pause.
"What if you get killed? What do we do then?"
Lars gave his driver a stare. He patted his augmetic leg. "They've tried killing me before," he said. "It didn't work." Hesk half smiled.
"No, really. What will happen?"
"Keep moving forward," Lars told him. Point 874, Trench System B, Myrak Salient. The sandbag bunker had a well-stamped earth floor, a simple field chart table, and a rack of las rifles stacked in the far corner. Colonel Jan Vetter of the Cadian Earthshakers paced back and forth. He cursed better than anyone in the combined regiment of the Cadian 290th, 140th Artillery, and he was in full flow as he raged down the vox at the Munitorum clerk in charge of resupply.
"Where are my shells?" he shouted,
and added a long line of expletives.
"We've had nothing for 2 days. My entire battery is silent."
He slammed his open palm down on the chart table. There was a pause before he started again.
"You told me that yesterday. I need shells. The assault is supposed to start in 10 minutes, and I still don't have my shells."
One of his staff officers, Yastin, touched his elbow and pointed. Headlights were arcing through the gloom. It was a Chimera chassis Salamander command vehicle. Vetter's staff looked hopeful. "I think they've arrived," Yastin said.
"They frecking better have,"
Vetter cursed as he climbed up out of his sandbagged bunker, standing up and raising a hand so he could see in the gloom. The 500-mile-long and 300-mile-wide Myrak Salient had been gradually shrinking back as Volscani armoured divisions had thrown themselves against the base of the salient, attempting to entrap the 17th Army within. 6 miles ahead, in the last lines of trenches, there was a terrible slaughter going on. You could smell smoke and cordite and rotting bodies even here. Vetter's regiment had been pummeling the attacking columns until their supplies of ordnance had run out. High command, as always, seemed oblivious. They had issued new targeting coordinates and a strict deadline for the bombardment to start, and Jan Vetter had been swearing ever since. On the vox, to his staff, and in a long and one-sided conversation with General Gruber, which had gone on mostly in his head. "Maybe the rumour is true," Vetter's adjutant, Yastin, said, as they waited for the Salamander to arrive. "Maybe we're going to attack."
"Well, we need frecking Earthshaker shells first," Vetter said. "We can't fire orders at the enemy." "Throne take them all. If Creed were here, he wouldn't let such a shambles go on.
The thought of Creed made them all feel a little better. The centaur's lights cast long beams, illuminating the swirling dirt and ash that swilled continuously up in the breeze.
Here!
Vetter shouted, though he could not be heard. He waved his torch, and the centaur's tracks slewed it toward him. Before it had even stopped, a comms officer was out, running low to the ground.
Are you the...
the officer started, but Vetter shouted over him.
Yes, he called out. You're late, and this freaking bombardment is supposed to start in 5 minutes.
The man's face showed a mixture of apology and resilient defiance.
It was tough getting through, he said.
Vetter didn't look for an explanation, but the man gave it anyway.
A maniple of warhounds broke through.
Vetter had seen the explosion and felt the earth tremors. He'd guessed something like that had happened, but this was someone else's problem, not his.
Well, I've got an artillery barrage to send.
The other man nodded. Fighting was starting up to the west. He could feel the tremors through his Cadian issue leather boots.
Right,
Vetter said.
There's 400 basilisks along this line. They're 3 deep,
he started. But the comms officer knew his business as well as Vetter, and already his supply chain of half-trucks and Trojans was peeling off and finding the dug-in basilisks. Within less than a minute, the first ordnance trucks were reversing into position behind the dug-in basilisk tanks. Neat lines of artillery shells were stacked 5 deep. The ammo carriages groaned under the weight of high explosives and cast metal. Crude, clawed servitor arms slowly began to pile the earthshaker shells onto the ground behind each gun. The whine of hydraulics seemed almost too loud.
Come on,
Vetter urged. But the supply crews were already at work, lifting the wooden pallets of earthshaker shells into position.
Gruber's going on the offensive.
I thought he could only walk backwards,
a young gunner said between breaths as he slid an earthshaker shell into the loading breech. Just the idea that they were going to go on the attack at last. It was intoxicating. There was giddy banter among the men. Vetter realized he hadn't heard anyone joke for, well, months.
Yes, indeed, guardsman, he grinned. Gruber wants us to move forward. We'll be in Khazar Kraft by midnight.
His vividly violet eye ran over the activity as the empty ammo trucks pulled away and others reversed in to take their place. A whistle blew. Vetter checked his chronometer. There was less than a minute to go.
Load!
He shouted, though the breeches were already loaded. He realized he'd been gripping the torch too tightly and flexed his hand. The nerves were getting to him. He cursed himself. Human, but Cadian. An air raid alarm sounded. At the end of the line, his anti-air turrets were swiveling to the west. Vetter couldn't see what was coming. The first Hydra started up, 4 lines of tracers streaked up into the sky. A direct hit into this mass of ordnance could blow them all to the Golden Throne. The fact didn't scare him. Vetter had seen death on 37 planets, and despite the steel plates in his femur and scapula, and the ache in his left shoulder, nothing had quite managed to finish him off. Another alarm started. The other two Hydras opened up. The 12 light trails seeming almost to bend as the automatic targeting sensors traced something flying towards them hard and low and fast.
Enemy flyers,
Yastin called out. Vetter nodded. He was counting down to 0 hour. A fireball curved off towards the south and impacted in a dull orange blast, hazy through the smoke of war. Vetter lifted his chainsword, thumbed the stud, and set the teeth spinning for a moment.
Make ready,
he shouted. The gun crews reacted with swift, effective, practiced movement. Vetter had come from the 340th Regiment, but the two had been merged so long it was hard to remember which of the old crews was from which unit. The months of fighting had thinned their ranks drastically, but the new recruits were shaping up well. Vetter held his arm aloft as another alarm sounded, and this time the Hydras swung round to the southeast. Soon, all their 20 anti-air platforms were engaged, fluid lines of tracer fire tracking the enemy.
Make ready,
Vetter ordered. He counted down the seconds. 8, 7, he counted, as a long metallic neck of brass and wires appeared from the gloom before them, soot trailing from its nostrils like a dragon of old. Between the counts of 7 and 5, the Helldrake's sinuous body emerged. It had wings of steel, and when its snout opened, it gave a scream like tearing sheet metal.
4,
There was a ripple of movement as the gun crews stood to, signalling that they were ready. The Vox officer, Dresk, was standing next to him. Vetter didn't even wait for the question.
Yes, he said. We're ready. Three.
Dresk turned to pass on the message.
Two.
Vetter allowed himself a deep breath in that tasted of ash and battle and smoke and death. Put the whistle to his lips and raised an arm.
One.
The guns fired on time, 400 basilisks roaring as one. It took 5 seconds before the next salvo rang out. Breaches were opened, cleared and rearmed, slammed shut and fired again. Not bad, Vetter thought, but his men could do better. By the sixth round, his crews were warming up. The barrage became a constant roar of thunder and smoke and recoiling earthshaker barrels. Inch by inch, gun crews adjusted the barrels, forcing the barrage forward at the pace a Lehman Russ could drive. Suddenly, Vetter remembered the flying demon engine that had been beating towards his lines. He looked about and saw nothing. Had it passed overhead, he thought, and looked up to where it had last been seen, flapping into the face of the guns. Bits of metal were falling from the sky like feathers. Chapter 3. Myrak Salient. In the shattered bunkers of Kaza Kraf, the South Polar Orbital Arrays, the island Kaza of the Kajikades Archipelago, all across Cadia where defenders still lived and fought, guardsmen sat waiting by their Vox units, their faces tense, their eyes downcast as they ran through the upcoming assault and their part within it. At 0 hour, the Vox units crackled to life, and Creed's voice ground out.
The fight back has begun, he told them. Have faith, have courage, have no mercy upon our foes.
Then whistles blew. The order was given. It was do or die. Decimated regiments that had been fighting for months had been thrown together according to availability, logic and chance. Infantry were paired with tank brigades, drop troops with armoured fist squads, scout regiments with artillery companies. The few massive line-busting Baneblades and their ilk were pulled together into squadrons and companies. There had been heated arguments and fights as regiments with proud and individual distinctions were merged with young regiments that lacked a long pedigree. The lieutenant of the Cadian Third, who were one of the founding regiments of the Cadian Gate, had refused to serve under the command of a colonel of the Cadian 4002nd Rifles, a unit that was itself an amalgamation of three other regiments, one of which had been decimated by the Commissariat after it had broken in the battle for the Gestel Heights in the Scaris sector. A major for the Cadian 99th Lancers had resigned his commission rather than serve under the command of an infantry officer. He led his Rough Rider squad in the first charge on the Nexus Gate, had two mounts shot from under him, and was last seen leading the survivors up the ramparts towards the enemy. But Cadian units followed the same professional codes of conduct and war. They all faced the same enemy. Unknown to the enemy and the Cadians alike, Krieg's hidden army were making their way out of the safety of the Salvation outposts. The scale of the counterattack was vast. On the far-flung continent of Cadia Tertius, servitors loaded squadrons of Thunderbolts and Marauder destroyers with Hellstrike missiles. Hidden launch bay doors opened, and squadron after squadron soared out to clear the skies of Cadia. On the plains of Cadia Primus, infantry regiments lined up at the underground armories as quartermasters unloaded hellguns and las rifles, flamers, grenade launchers, demolition charges, heavy bolters, autocannons and las cannons with well-oiled tripods. The speeches of Creed rang out over the Vox relays, and the fury of the warriors, who had chafed at their isolation, became as cold and merciless as a freshly whetted blade. It took some regiments 2 days to make the climb to the sally points. Under the hills of Cadia Secundus, armoured units were brought up from the depths by vast lift halls that carried whole squadrons of tanks at a time. The closer to the surface they came, the stronger the scent of ash and burning. Then, at last, they stood before the closed sally ports, and the tramp of boots came to a halt. For some of the troops waiting at the doors, it was hours of standing. Others arrived only moments before the scheduled opening of the Salvation Gates. Generals, majors, colonels, lieutenants and sergeants all made their speeches, some long and erudite, others short and curse-filled and to the point. Across Cadia Primus and Secundus, millions of elite Cadian shock troopers gripped their guns tighter, ground their teeth, cursed the enemies of the Imperium of Man, and readied themselves for war. That morning, Cadia fought back. In the trenches of the Myrax salient, whistles blew, and whole platoons moved up over the top in a hail of heavy stubbers and bolters. Armoured fist squads, loaded into their chimeras, charged across no man's land in columns five wide, their turret-mounted autocannons and multi-lasers tracking for targets. Tank regiments with honour rolls that stretched back 8,000 years moved out, battle cannons smoking. Airborne units lifted off, packed into Valkyries that flew low to the ground, side gunners scanning for targets. For some unlucky regiments, the time arrived, the codes were tapped into locking panels, and nothing happened. The Earth had been so transformed by orbital bombardment that the doors of their bunkers would not open, and the units realized that they were trapped. But most who charged out on Cadia Primus found a land devastated by war. The land they knew was now an unfamiliar maze of craters. Proud cities were burned and empty shells. Vast tank graveyards showed where battles had raged on the surface, and the land had been turned black, as if a wildfire had crossed the entire planet and scorched everything in its path. Each unit had coordinates to head to, objectives to seize, but for many of them, the battles had already been lost, the Khazza they were meant to be relieving already plundered.
"There's been a wildfire," General Justice declared to his men. "It is the arch-heretic. It is Abaddon. He is responsible. It is him we hate, and all who follow him."
On the burning plains of Cadia Primus, many units found themselves surrounded by iron warriors. The lead tanks of the Cadian 652nd Armored Brigade suddenly erupted in flame. And as the rest of the company tried to move around them, they were also taken out with well-aimed lascannon shots. The column ground to a halt as tank commanders made desperate attempts to move the burning wrecks out of the way, while more and more of the column was torn apart by an enemy they could not see. A few tank commanders attempted to fire back, but it was a hopeless task, and soon iron warriors ran amok through the parked columns until the whole bunker was a roiling mess of fumes and fire. As the scale of slaughter on Cadia Primus grew in horror and violence, foul sorceries were unleashed, and the bounds that held the Immaterium back began to weaken. Amid the black and smoke, lurid and impossible shapes appeared. Red packs of vicious, horned monsters tore tanks apart with their claws and unholy swords. Vast winged shapes loomed up with battle axes the size of a sentinel, snarling and gnashing and howling for blood. Men were struck dumb with terror. The immense demons crushed tanks with a single blow of their axes or a stamp of their red hoofed feet. Although they were millions strong, the forces of Cadia found themselves outnumbered and overpowered. But despite everything, they resisted with all their strength. Proud regiments who had carried victory across the Imperium of Man each found a hill or a mound, planted their banners in the burned earth, firing and bayoneting at the waves of heretics, inch by inch being slowly overwhelmed like an atoll being swallowed up by a rising sea. The continent of Cadia Secundus had been hit less hard than those to the north, and here the forces of Cadia had fared better. There were many places, such as Bastion 8, where command and control retained a firm grip. The defenders charged out, and many of them shared the same experience as Lars when he led his tank column forward.
"Contact!"
he voxed. His guns were loaded. His targeter was already winding the barrel round.
"Tanks!"
Lars voxed to his unit. He was going to say dozens, but he could see that he was wrong. There were 100 tanks at least, more and more streaming up from the ground before him.
"Holy throne," he said. "Hold your fire! They're Cadian!"
The two columns came together, lead tank to lead tank. Lars shook his head in amazement.
"Benedict? Is that you?"
From the Salvation outposts, whole armies appeared, fresh and ready for battle. The tide of war began to change, and across the continent, Cadian forces felt the sudden injection of fresh troops rock the heretic forces back, and many made swift progress. At the Primus Junction, the 79th Armoured Regiment crashed through a section of line held by the Volscani cataphracts, firing plasma guns from the back of the Chimera transports, killing the heretics and their thousands. The 992nd, 328th, 674th Scout Regiment had a combined force of over 600 sentinels, armed with multilasers and autocannons, and 50 with las cannons. Under the cover of a short-range artillery barrage from the 200 Medusas of the 1911th Artillery Regiment, the Scout Sentinels moved forward, led by the veteran Sentinel pilot, Lieutenant Esther Vath. As they approached the trenches of the enemy, the phalanx of walkers accelerated into a loping run, heavily armoured Sentinels screaming the lighter units behind. The Sentinels came under sustained enfilading fire from heavy bolters and las cannons, and lost over 50 walkers in a matter of minutes. For a moment, it seemed that the charge would be thrown back. But then Esther Vath charged the lines of the enemy, singing imperial hymns. The massed sentinel column hit the trenches and the fury of the Volscani foot soldiers. There was a brief and furious fight as the sentinels kicked and stomped their way through the fore. They would have stalled until a sudden white light appeared in the sky and drove the enemy back. Some claimed to have seen a bright human shape in the sky. Some saw Creed. Either way, the momentary shock it inflicted on the enemy allowed the heavy flamer-armed sentinels to rush up and bathe the heretic trenches with burning promethium. Dark shapes leapt about in the torrent of burning, and then they fell, submerged and overcome with smoke and fumes, and the sentinel drivers stamped out any that made it out. There was a furious battle of man and machine, and then, in less than half an hour, they were through, into open ground, wreaking a heavy cost on the supply trucks of the enemy and widening the hole in their line. In some parts of the battlefront, command and control had been hit so many times by Black Legion terror squads that even the famous Cadian discipline was starting to creak under the pressure. The effectiveness of the attacks was haphazard and sometimes counterproductive. The Cadian 987th 23rd Tank Regiment set off 3 hours too early. Their 63 Lehman Russes and 2 Hydra flak tanks smashed through the heretic cultists along Sublime Ridge and ploughed on through 6 miles of hastily thrown up defences, hellhounds scouting ahead and to either side, filling the trenches with burning promethium and allowing the main battle tanks to keep on rolling towards their objective, the heights to the north of Kazamairak. Their commander, a Cadian veteran of only 35 years, known as Bold Brask, sighted an enemy tank formation coming towards them and destroyed it in a firefight that lasted less than 2 hours, leaving wrecks burning over 15 miles of the Myrak foothills. It seemed at first that the misstep would prove a bold and brilliant move, but their assault went too far, too fast, and it was not long before the enemy reacted and the tanks were set upon by a flock of metal carrion that covered the armour in flame and boiled the crews alive inside their vehicles. The Hydra tanks put up a solid defence, but to no avail. And once one had been destroyed, the task before the other was too great. It was picked off by 3 of the creatures, which came at it from all sides, like carrion birds mobbing a wounded beast. With their air defence destroyed, the rest of the tank column was exposed and isolated. Bold Brask's Exterminator Pattern Lehman Russ battle tank had been winged by a lucky missile strike and was making slow speed towards the shelter of a charcoal forest of bare stumps when it was set upon by 7 of the flying machines. Brask was manning the turret autocannons. As soon as they were in range, he started to fire. Spent shells rattled off the tank hull like a hailstorm, and the tracers made an almost continuous line of light.
"Have faith,"
Brask told his crew. And they were Cadian, tough, remorseless, realistic. He hit a flying creature in the wing. It spiraled down to earth and hit the ground head first. Its back was broken in an instant. He hit another in the breast, a sustained volley that tore wing from body. The third swelled up into the air for a moment, managing to stay just ahead of the autocannon rounds as 2 more flew in from behind. Bold Brask had a moment's warning, as the roar of their coming was like the sound of a gale in the high veldt pines. A moment was all he needed. He dropped down into the tank and pulled the cupola down behind him, one half turn, locking it shut. For a moment, there was silence. And then another roar as the monsters breathed upon the sealed tank. The heat inside rose alarmingly as the flame torrent continued. There was a clunk as one of the tracks came loose, a cough as the engine gave up, and still the flame torrent continued.
"Freck!"
Brask cursed as the vision slits glowed with a bright blue light. Within seconds, the temperature had risen even more alarmingly. Thinner patches of the ceramite armour began to glow a dull red and then orange.
"We're going to cook!"
Cota screamed from the driver's seat as the inside of the cramped Lehman Russ cabin went from frigid to scalding hot. He threw off his leather straps. Brask tried to speak, but he found himself gasping for breath. The firestorm was sucking all the oxygen out of the air. The vision slits hissed as their temperature soared, and then something dripped onto Brask's hand and he cried out in pain. The black plastic knob that locked the top hatch had melted and was dripping. Burst relay pipes under the floor sent hot jets of steam and scalding water into the cabin. Brask cursed as he tried to flick the dripping substance off his skin. The air stank of ozone. He used his gloved hand to open the top hatch. Another black drip fell onto his cheek. There was smoke in the cabin, and it caught in the back of his throat. He kicked as he pushed himself out of the Lehman Russ and into the flames. Colonel Valentin of the Cadian 47th Fire Dogs had spent his months in Salvation 37A, getting drunk on a ton of fine Scarus Amasek that had somehow replaced a large section of their ration supply. When the time came for the lifts to the surface, the engine of his Hellhound assault tank was turning over nicely as he shared a last shot of Amasek with his other commanders, then clambered unsteadily into its cupola. He was largely sober when he led his unit of Hellhounds and assorted assault tanks up to the surface, but was sporting the mother of all hangovers as he pulled his white silk scarf about his neck and waved his column forward into the grey smog that passed for a day on Cadia.
"Forward, brothers!"
he shouted, not even bothering to broadcast over the Vox channels. He didn't even check his coordinates. He didn't need to. It was clear where the enemy trench lines were from the tangle of razor wire and the dull shine of Aegis defence lines scoured of camel paint by the weight of fire that had been thrown against them. 1 minute before the attack was due to start, his whole company of 500 assault tanks was in position at the head of a force of over 2,000 tanks that were arranged in battalions behind him.
"Ready, sir?"
his driver, Mator, called up. Bannerton's scarf flapped in the breeze.
"Can't fricking wait."
The opening salvos of the bombardment drowned out his words. They made the earth shake and the sky tremble as the world filled with a roaring maelstrom of sound and fury. Valentin put the scopes to his eyes and watched the heretic lines erupting with fountains of earth and smoke. The precision of the barrage was awe-inspiring. It hit the front line with almost clinical discipline, throwing up a line of mud as if a long underground charge had suddenly been ignited.
"Holy throne!" Valentin laughed as his tank trembled.
It felt to him that his vehicle was a living thing, eager to get at the foe. It was the heretic's turn now to taste hell.
"Who else is spearheading this attack?"
Mattel shouted up.
"Steel Punch and Cadian Stalwarts."
Valentin could see the other assault tank brigades moving into position on either side. He felt a sudden panic that they would start first and steal his glory. Valentin's head was still light with alcohol. Their attack details had been meticulously timed with the barrage, but Valentin could not wait. Half a minute before the bombardment was due to move on, he signalled his driver, and the Hellhound tank lurched forward, camo netting swirling in the draft of its own passing. Behind him, his whole column started to move forward, tracks spinning and dust rising in their wake. It was a half a mile to the heretic lines. Valentin's scarf flew out almost straight behind him as his tank led the charge. Amid the ruin and the explosions, he could see shapes desperately trying to man guns or falling back in confusion as the massed hellhounds sped across the open ground, their tracks skidding as they kicked up the dirt. The barrage crept forward as the hellhounds closed the last 100 yards. It was a race now for the assault company to cross the ground before the surviving heretics could man their anti-tank weapons. Valentin was halfway across the open ground when the first shots began to flare out towards them. Tracer fire streaked the sky as heavy weapons opened up from pillboxes and emplacements. He laughed at the sudden light show whizzing past his ears. The firing was wild and disorganized. That any were managing to fire with the bombardment that was raining down on them seemed remarkable. He did not duck. He had never felt so alive as at that moment, with the fury of the heretic blasting out at him.
Take fire to the enemy, he called to his crews. Faith in the Emperor of Mankind.
At the end of his speech, he cried,
Cadia stands!
As autocannon shells rang out on the armour of the Hellhound. The rangefinder spiralled down. At 150 yards, he tested the flame cannons. The nozzle of the Hellhound cannon gave a brief spurt of liquid fire, a thin, pressurised cone that fanned out into a swirl of flames. Hellhound-grade promethium filled his nostrils. It felt good, despite his hangover, helped his mind focus. At 100 yards, Valentin slipped down into the firing position and began to pan the Aegis line on the left for a target. It was draped with the dead bodies of guardsmen used as sandbags. There was at least one heavy weapons team in there, guessing from the lines of traces. A missile arched out and hit the tank to Valentin's right. The explosion underlit the clouds with red and yellow as its fuel tanks combusted. Inches thick, a blade of armour ripped open like paper. A torrent of fire gouted 200 yards into the air, and then, long seconds later, bits of burning metal began to rain down. Valentin barely noticed it. He tracked, aimed, and fired, and the plume of fuel arced out, feathering with flames. His targeter flared green as the flames overloaded the sensors. He let the flames linger for a moment on the pillbox. The liquid fuel poured in through the narrow vents and filled the interior with an incandescent fire. His tank was already moving on to the next. There was a thud as the Hellhound hit the wire. The barbed coils held for a moment, the tracks spinning. There was a screech of metal as the wire snapped, and the Hellhound surged onwards. It hit the Aegis line with a judder that threw Valentin forward. Matto gunned the engine, and the tank veered up, belly exposed for a terrifying moment, before they crashed back down again, slamming forward on the simple suspension. Valentin swung around to pour fire into the enemy lines. The first gout filled the first trench like a canal of knee-high promethium all aflame. The next arced towards the second Aegis line. The third hit a squad of heretics rushing forward, bent low, demo charges in hand. Valentin grinned as dark shapes tumbled out of the inferno.
Dance, heretics, dance!
Then the demo charges blew, and there was the wet slap of body parts hitting the front of his tank. Matto tracked around. There was a dull thud of a human being knocked to the ground and crushed, not the note of a melter or crack charge. Behind him, Valentin's column was hitting the heretic lines, widening the hole that they'd punched through. On Valentin's right, a Hellhound, it must have been Kristen's, hit a mine and slewed sideways. It came to rest in a shell hole, nozzle flame still hissing menacingly. Another lifted up over the Aegis defence line and was hit in the belly with a close-range melter shot that ripped through the Hellhound and combusted the reinforced armoured fuel tanks. It was lifted 20 feet off the ground with the explosion and fired burning wreckage across the battlefield, 100 yards in all directions. He pressed his vox stud to all channels.
All tanks, proceed south, Valentin ordered. Maximum speed, maximum violence. Cadia stands.
Cadia stands was repeated in every tank. They plunged forward, smashing into the second, third, and fourth lines of defence, the pause in their momentum longer each time before they pushed through. This was the crucial moment. They had to keep pressing forward despite the losses, forever pushing through for open ground. Hauser's tank got snared in a wire and came to a skidding halt. A missile arced out and hit it on the armoured flanks. There was a pause, and then it started to burn. The driver's hatch slapped open, and flames began to rise within.
Out, damn it, Valentin willed.
But whoever had managed to get the hatch open did not appear. Maybe they'd gone back to help someone, Valentin thought.
Out,
he willed, punching the cupola before him. But then the fire spread, and the whole tank went up with a hiss of flames that built to a blowtorch roar. Valentin drew his pistol, shot an axe-wielding heretic through the forehead.
Forward!
He raged, as his inferno cannon blazed out once more. Chapter 4. Bastion 8, Myrak Salient. Bastion 8 was a rock-creaked star, sunk into a dry moat 50 yards wide, the largest of a string of ancient defences that ringed the highlands, excavated with atomic bunkers, barracks, ration stores and munitions depots, and stoutly fortified in 3 stepped levels, each one offering enfilading fields of fire in all directions. It was from there that General Gruber launched his counterattack. He rode in a Baneblade named High Lord, a magnificent brass-worked masterpiece with four lascannon sponsons and a raised cupola throne. It trundled forward, Cadians raising their lasguns in salute. They passed over the trench systems and pushed forward through the detritus of war, chasing the front line as it pushed deeper and deeper into the guts of the heretic army. The High Lord ripped through the trench systems of the four, its main guns pummeling any armoured resistance, while sponsons tore the combat's dim-induced fighters apart with heavy bolt shells as long as a man's hand. The vast tracks barely noticed the tank traps and trench systems that had been worked with so much care by the enemy. The Baneblade crossed six lines of trenches. At midday on the first day of the assault, an improvised column of Black Legion tanks was thrown against it. They came rumbling forward across the burned open moorland, black banners flapping in the smoke-dark air. The Baneblade smashed through craters and piles of wreckage. It took four gunners to man the Baneblade's main cannon. They assessed the danger, pinpointed a vanquisher at the back of the column, and swung the turret round. It took them only a few seconds to line up the tank and fire. The Baneblade shell tore a hole in the armour of the Lehman Russ wide enough for a man to climb through. Its explosion ripped the tank into shrapnel. On the foredeck of the Baneblade, the demolisher cannon targeted the closest of the enemy tanks and fired a rocket-propelled siege round at it. When the smoke cleared, there was nothing left of tank or shell but a smouldering crater and a few scraps of burning metal. All units were pushing forward. It was as if the crack had opened into a vast dam. The torrent was too fast and too powerful, the head of water too great to be held back. The gap opened wider, until Cadian units were pushing forward on a 16-mile front with infantry and supply craft coming up behind them. All the time, their massed artillery regiments were hammering the enemy backlines, preventing them bringing up reinforcements or even mounting an effective response. Gruber sat on the throne, sword drawn. His attendants begged for him to come down and protect himself. Gruber was stern. "Who dares to stand against us?" Across much of the Myrax salient, the earth was pocked with craters, the vegetation scoured away or burned black with war. The prospect was one the Cadians were familiar with as they moved forward by foot or in armoured transports. Captain Lation's 114th Cadians made rapid progress, defeating three small tank forces that had been sent to halt him. The first two were units of heretic guardsmen manning captured tanks and armoured transports. They were easy prey for the elite Cadian units, their ruins left burning as the Cadians pushed on. But the third was a pair of Black Legion Predator tanks that fought a desperate and effective battle, sniping, falling back, and sniping once more. Lation lost three Lehman Russ tanks and sustained damage to two more before his gunner managed to catch a Predator as it sped between the ruins, hitting it with a battle cannon round to the weak side armour. The Predator was lifted up by the explosion and slammed back to the ground, a broken and burning shell. A second tried to retreat between the rocks, speeding backwards, trailing smoke into the air. Lation had fought on the mist-bound moors of Mena and had a knack of guessing where a foe was heading. "Crack!" he ordered, as the gunner dragged an armour-piercing round from the magazine, turned it and slid it onto the loading ramp.
"Loaded!"
the driver said, throwing the gun door shut and locking it closed. Lation elevated the gun barrel, adding another 50 feet to the shot. He made a quick prayer to the Golden Throne, then fired. The round arced off, leaving a swirling track as it plunged through the ink-black smoke. There was a pause as the cloud wound in upon itself, and then there was a sudden flash of flame that shot straight up into the air like a furnace blast. Lation led the column forward, checking that the second tank had been destroyed. The Predator had been hit on the turret, and the armor-piercing round had burned a neat hole through the reinforced plating and exploded within the tank, igniting the magazine. It was a hit that would have instantaneously killed an Imperial Guard crew, but one of the traitor Space Marines had survived, horribly wounded. Its legs had been blown away, and half its face had been burned down to the bone, but it was still alive. "Bring us close," Lation ordered his driver. Leshin's tank stopped 20 feet away from the wounded space marine. Goldberg, his gunner, spoke.
What should I load, sir?
Leshin paused for a moment. Nothing. The thing was huge, malformed, inhuman. Its eyes were yellow with vertical slits like a snake's. When its ruined mouth moved, Leshin knew there were words there, though it was an accent he could not understand. He slid down from his tank and landed on both feet. I do not fear you, he shouted. He felt courage from his words. The thing snarled at him. The size of the traitor before him only became apparent as Leshin drew closer. Its chest was as wide as some men were tall. It was massive, solid, though terribly wounded, and still moving as it struggled for breath. Leshin drew his service's issue las pistol. He set the charge to the max, lifted the gun, and sighted the thing's forehead. This time, he understood the accent.
Fire true, Captain.
Leshin felt sick at the sound of the thing's voice. His hand shook as it stared into him. The light of its eyes turned orange and then red, like a real fire burning.
Shoot, Captain.
Leshin fired. The first shot hit the traitor on the side of the cheek. It scored a deep burn.
Again,
it hissed at him. Leshin's hand was shaking now. The next shot missed. He stepped forward for the third and held the pistol with both hands.
In the name of the God Emperor of Mankind, he called out, and fired a third time.
Sallyport, Salvation 9983. It felt good to be driving again. Bendict stood in the turret of his tank and breathed a moment deep. But even as he led his column forward, he waited for his Vox officer to connect to General Gruber. Gruber's voice was tight and drawn.
What is your strength? He demanded.
Bendict knew the figure off by heart. He was leading 1,500 Lehman Russ tanks, assorted patents, 50 Hydra defense platforms, a squadron of assault tanks, 39 knights errant, 100,000 mechanized infantry, 10,000 Kazrakin. Bendict allowed himself a smile.
We make up the 207th Army.
There was a long pause that Bendict enjoyed.
You are sure of your numbers?
Gruber's voice queried.
All correct. What is your position?
Bendict checked.
Point 73. 207th Army is not on my list.
We're new. There was another long pause.
That is impossible.
Bendict paused.
Location confirmed, point 73. You cannot be.
We are, General Gruber. Gruber's voice was curt.
I said that is impossible. Please check and confirm immediately.
Bendict paused for a moment. He did not bother checking, but brought the Voxlink back up to his mouth.
Confirmed, sir. You are 20 miles behind enemy lines.
Confirmed.
Lead your forces to cut off hostile army units.
I'm afraid I cannot.
What do you mean?
I have orders from the Lord Castellan Ursarka E. Creed.
And what are those orders?
I cannot tell you. Gruber put on his officious voice.
Major Bendict, you are addressing a general of the Astra Militarum.
Bendict let the moment hang and engaged the Voxstud.
Yes, General Gruber, I am also a general. I have my own orders. I will be following those.
Good hunting. A battalion of Volscani defended the pontoon bridges over the Myrak River. Behind them, in the far distance, the pylons of the Elysian fields rose up against the horizon. Bendict used a scope to assess their position. 3 Lehman Russes and a destroyer tank dug into the riverbanks. The heretic unit put up a commendable defence. Their infantry squads were dug into foxholes. Missiles arced out from them as the tanks fired at a furious rate. The 89th Army Group demolished them in less than 10 minutes, and Bendict led his army out over the Myrak River and past their burning wrecks, the Volscani troops lying dead. In 2 hours, his army had crossed to the other side. They paused to refuel, rearm, and regroup, and then they were off again, batting away 3 heretic forces that were flung at them. It was not until nightfall that they met serious opposition. A Black Legion column that had been diverted to impede their progress. The traitor Space Marines brought Bendict's army to a halt for nearly 2 hours as outflanking units enveloped them and they slowly ground the Black Legion down. The battlefield was littered with burning wrecks. They belched black smoke into the gathering gloom. Bendict's tank was pushing cautiously through when Mia called up to him.
Lord General, Mia said. It's the Lord Castellan.
Bendict nodded as he took the voxlink and started to speak, but Creed cut him off.
Bendict, he said. Where are you?
We've crossed the Myrak River.
Good, Creed said. Well done, but I need more. Can you reach the Elysian Fields by dawn?
It was 50 miles.
Confirmed, Bendict said. We'll be there.
Creed's voice sounded strained and weary. Bendict could imagine him putting his fingers to his temples and rubbing them before he spoke.
Thank you. Do all you can, please. You are the closest troops. Please do your best. Cadia depends on it.
Chapter 5, 17th Army Group, Myrak Front. War lit Cadia. It was as if the planet burned. On the surface, raging firestorms lit up miles and miles of battlefront, while overhead, lightning storms in the high atmosphere illuminated the night sky, punctuated by blinding flashes as warships died in cataclysmic explosions, their plasma reactors going nuclear and the burning wrecks falling towards the planet like vast flares hanging in the darkness. All was war. And gleaming above it, the Eye of Terror pulsed and bulged as arcane sorceries were invoked. The vast globe swirled with vivid purple and yellow, blotches of unholy light pulsing and fading in sickening patterns. Under the hellflames, General Gruber's army hammered relentlessly at the armies before them, slaughtering heretics as they howled and shrieked forwards. The forces they faced were high on frenzen. For a day they battled through the endless tide of screaming bodies. Lena was on the left wing, with one of the surviving armoured units of the Cadian 8th, Lord Castellan's own. She had been a sponson gunner at Tyrock Fields, but with war and field promotions, she had risen to main gunner on the riser pattern demolisher, Hammer of Tyrock. The Hammer was a temperamental beast of a tank, and on the second day of the assault, her engines started to clang dangerously. Then she ground to a halt. In the absence of a tech priest, it fell to Lena. She was the best at coaxing unhappy machine spirits.
It's your soft hands, Ibsic said.
Freck you, Lena told him, as she lay under the tank, trying to unscrew the drive shaft panels. Tanks filed past on either side. Commanders had cloths tied over their faces. Some waved, all stared. A Titan-hunting squadron of 3 Shadow Swords trundled past, their service tanks skittering about them. It was a magnificent sight, with scout sentinels, a brigade of Hydras, and a complement of ancillary support vehicles and tanks. In the centre of the great convoy were the 3 Shadow Swords, their fixed volcano cannons still smoking. Lena let out a long, low whistle. It was only when you compared the size of a Shadow Sword to a Lehman Russ that you got a sense of the scale of these things. The immense tank crested the rise, the fixed gun swinging towards her as it descended.
Look at those, she said,
and started laughing as a second and third behemoth crested the ridge. Just behind the sponson weapon cabins, the side hatches squeaked as they swung open. Her crew spilled out and stood beside the tank to watch.
Holy throne, one said.
Freck, said another.
It took half an hour for the Titan Hunter squadron to make their way across the veldt. The sight of a pair of tech priest chimeras frustrated Ibsic. It wouldn't take one of them long to fix Hammer. But with each minute, their unit was racing farther and farther ahead. Lena was down there for more than an hour. She finally slid herself out from under the tank, sat up and rubbed lubricants from her hands.
Got it fixed?
I think so. She was climbing up when there was a sudden flash of light and then a rolling boom. Lena ducked.
What was that?
Ibsic had his scopes out.
I think they just nailed the Titan, he told her. 70 degrees west.
Lena grabbed the scopes. The landscape before her was flat, marked only with wreckage from the sky battle, which stood up from the ground like tufts of burning grass.
I don't see it, she said,
2 hours later, they reached the place where the Titan attack had been stalled. A dead warhound lay on its back, like a drunken man in a downhive bar, legs wide and head tilted back in a posture of utter debasement. Smoke rose from a hole in its chest cavity, a thick, noxious blend of promethium, lubricants, and human flesh, all burned to ignition by the heat of the impacts.
"Look at that," Hipsick said.
Their tank slowed to a crawl. Lena pushed her way up out of the cupola. The size of the dead machine was breathtaking. The paintwork of the Titan was chipped and worn. The barrels of the turbo laser were blackened and heat-stained. The ammo feed of its Vulcan mega bolter had broken open and spilt bolt shells across the ground. She took in the size of the shells.
Freck.
The fight was still going on. The flashes strobed Lena's face as she looked out.
Keep the gun loaded, Hipsick warned her.
Dan, she said. There was good hunting that morning. In the ferocious battles, the heretic counterattacks were held and thrown back. They came across 3 more dead renegade titans in the next 5 miles. The last was a jackal class. It had been knocked out perhaps half an hour earlier, and had not yet been isolated by the tech priests. As Lena's tank approached, a Mechanicus Chimera pulled up alongside the stricken titan. Lena watched as a tech priest glided out, octopus-like, on a bed of coiling mechadendrites. It reached the head of the scout titan. Mechadendrites touched the titan's head, and a shudder went through the great construct. And then the head lolled limply to the side. It was like watching a farmer put a bolt into the brain of a grox. Lena looked away. Let's get out of here, she said. But Kazrakin were holding the lines of armor back as a shadow sword drove up. The super-heavy tank came to a halt, a thin wisp of smoke still rising from the volcano cannon. The battery fans were still blasting cold air through the cooling systems. Behind the cannon, the hatch opened, and a slim, hawkish man climbed up, put his hand to the side of the mammoth tank, and slid down the side of the fixed gun mounting. The tank commander walked along the shadow sword's decking, one hand to the gun barrel to steady himself. He wore the markings of a tank ace, but it was his poise that Lena found instantly intriguing. It was like watching a peacock. He came down one of the metal ladders, jumped the last 10 feet, and landed squarely. When he turned towards her, Lena saw the handsomely scarred mouth and silver gorget. She knew straight away who he was and nudged Hipsick.
It's Pask, she hissed,
but Hipsick had seen at the same time. Pask pushed up his peaked cap and strolled over to the dead titan. He put a hand against one of its vast three-jointed toes. He struck the pose of a big game hunter on a death world.
7 in 2 days. Not bad.
Lena didn't know what to say.
I think we've broken them, Hipsick called out.
Pask looked up.
Yes.
He pointed up to the sky. They glimpsed the lightning flashes of a naval battle.
Terra has answered our call.
Lena didn't know what he meant.
The Imperial Fists chapter have come to our aid. They have brought the phalanx.
Lena nodded, but she didn't really know what he was talking about.
We've got them beaten,
Pask gave a short, weary smile.
Now we need to punish them, make sure they never forget it.
He turned his back and returned to his shadow sword.
We have to make sure they never dare to attack us again.
For the rest of the day, Gruber's 17th Army plunged through heretic armies like a stiletto blade. He was fearless when they stormed the enemy strong points, his bane blade lending its weight to the attack whenever it appeared to stall. He made an obvious target, and his armor saved him from sniper fire a number of times. He took a shot to his leg but refused to step down, and insisted that the Medicaid dressed his wound there, on top of the bane blade. Lena was involved in 2 battles, one against a column of chimeras, the other against a tank brigade dug into the slopes of a low rise above the river valley. That day, Creed's broadcast did not come. But there was so much to do that the attacks pushed on regardless. Creed did not broadcast the next day either. It was night when the vox box spluttered to life, an hour before dawn. Lena was curled up in the bottom of her tank. Her head was pressed up against the hard metal of the magazine floor. Flower of Cadia started to play, and she felt a prickle of fear go through her.
Hipsick, she called.
He was sleeping in a hammock slung above her. She had to poke him with a finger to wake him.
It's Creed!
Ipsic flicked a light on.
Turn it up,
she told him. He turned the vox head up, but as the tune came to its end, Creed's voice did not come. There was nothing but the crackle of static. Lena felt her heart begin to beat faster. Something was wrong. But then a woman's voice started to speak.
The Emperor asks only that you obey. Intolerance is a blessing. The faithful dead watch over you. The martyr's grave is the foundation of the Imperium. The only crime is cowardice.
Lena had to shake Ipsic.
What's wrong with it? Delante!
Delante, the driver, had the best touch with the vox. He crawled back and fiddled with the controls. The military music came in and out. He gave up.
It's working, he said. It can't be.
Lena slammed a hand onto the top of the machine.
She's just reading from the Tome of Uplifting Thoughts. Something's wrong. I can feel it. Something is terribly wrong.
Chapter 6. Guild Quarter, Kazamairak. In Kazamairak, the buildings along the north side of Statue Square were burning. Rath's company had lost their vox when they'd fallen back. Volscani kill teams had come up behind them. The jaws had snapped about them, and too many of them had been caught. Yelena's squad had been taken alive. Somehow, Minka had slipped out, but not until she'd found the bodies.
They were all dead, Minka told them.
She looked at her hands.
They were skinned.
Rath was still covered in dust. He stood up. He squeezed her shoulder with his hand. She waited for him to say something, but he had no words, no encouragement, nothing. There were only 30-odd left. They had their backs to the river. They had taken a beating. There was more to come. Minka closed her eyes, but all she could see was Yelena's squad, each wet corpse hanging like meat from the lamppost along Munitorum Street. She shook herself.
Now there's just us, Tavi said.
Rath nodded. He had his back to them.
When will they come for us?
Rath turned.